You will hear a discussion in which two people, Sam Williamson and Kathleen Smithson, talk about strategies to help the poor in resource-rich developing countries. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C, or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part 3.
In 2008, oil and mineral exports from developing countries were worth about $393 billion, which was 5 times higher than those of farming products and foreign aid put together. If used correctly, this revenue could be used to free millions from poverty. Why hasn't there been extensive relief from poverty, and what can be done to rectify the situation?
The answer to your first question is quite simple. It's because those who benefit from the oil and mineral resources in developing countries are the elite from those countries and the companies involved in extracting them. When this happens, we have a situation known as the paradox of plenty. This term is used to describe the phenomenon whereby countries rich in natural resources like oil, gas, and minerals end up poorer than those without them. And by poorer, I don't mean the financial worth of the developing country and its citizens, but the way in which the revenue from those resources is spread, with those at the top becoming much richer and the gap between them and the poor growing ever wider. Because of the corruption that is caused by the government and other elite groups placing their interests above their responsibilities to the people, there is injustice and instability. Democracy and basic human rights are undermined. And there is a decline in competitiveness of the economic sector, as well as volatility on commodity markets. As for tackling the problem, the only way forward is to draw up social contracts with communities through transparency to ensure that they too benefit from the revenue from the resources.
I agree that transparency is the key, and it's been proven. In 2009, the Sierra Leone government signed a deal with a foreign mining company. But when the contract was made public, there was widespread condemnation of it, as it did not comply with the law. Eventually, there were some changes made, but it would have been better if there had been an open contracting process in the first place.
That's exactly what happened when the mining company I was working for in Ghana insisted that the Ghanaian government officials make the contract public before it was put before Parliament for ratification. When we requested such openness, I think they were taken aback because this process had never been adopted in West Africa before, and it set the bar really high for other foreign companies doing business in the area, as it became a precedent that helped build trust and credibility. It was a win-win situation for the country as a whole and the investor.
Those situations in Sierra Leone and Ghana, however, seem to be the exception rather than the rule. The community leaders I've spoken to say that it's great to have access to revenue information, but all too often there is little impact or change at ground level. In other words, new schools, roads, and public services have not materialized. So, in my opinion, transparency, in which the public is made aware of the nature of contracts drawn up between the government and companies, must only be treated as a single prerequisite step in the fight against poverty. If that transparency results in accountability and people don't turn a blind eye to the terms of the contract, then money can be spent on sustainable development.
That's a good point. When contracts are open to public scrutiny, government officials know they will be accountable for the terms of the deal and will be under public pressure to sign deals that are acceptable for citizens. Then, systematic transparency will be adopted as the norm, and all stakeholders will be involved in the negotiating process.
Again, that's a good starting point, but it's one thing to make government documents available to the public in their original form, and it's quite another to ensure that communities understand what the contracts entail. It takes years of professional training to be able to plough through legalese, the complex language of the law, and grasp the meaning precisely. Rather than exploiting this to maintain the communication gap, some governments have changed the form of the documents, using new tools that simplify the contracts in order to distribute information that can be readily understood. Then communities can gauge the real-life impact of contracts drawn up by governments and companies involved in extracting natural resources.
And when communication channels are clear, negotiations can be conducted without government intervention. Take, for example, the agreement made between Rio Tinto and the indigenous community in Australia. The meeting not only involved discussing the best way to distribute revenue from the mining operations, but also how to reduce poverty. And there were other issues on the agenda too. Discussions centered around the mining not compromising the quality of the soil, air and water so that the operations would not lead to serious health concerns. I only hope that such negotiations set a precedent for other operations related to natural resources, and they become the norm rather than the exception.
Now you will hear part three again.
In 2008, oil and mineral exports from developing countries were worth about $393 billion, which was five times higher than those of farming products and foreign aid put together. If used correctly, this revenue could be used to free millions from poverty. Why hasn't there been extensive relief from poverty? And what can be done to rectify the situation?
The answer to your first question is quite simple. It's because those who benefit from the oil and mineral resources in developing countries are the elite from those countries and the companies involved in extracting them. When this happens, we have a situation known as the paradox of plenty. This term is used to describe the phenomenon whereby countries rich in natural resources like oil, gas, and minerals end up poorer than those without them. And by poorer, I don't mean the financial worth of the developing country and its citizens, but the way in which the revenue from those resources is spread, with those at the top becoming much richer and the gap between them and the poor growing ever wider. Because of the corruption that is caused by the government and other elite groups placing their interests above their responsibilities to the people, there is injustice and instability. Democracy and basic human rights are undermined, and there is a decline in competitiveness of the economic sector, as well as volatility on commodity markets. As for tackling the problem, the only way forward is to draw up social contracts with communities through transparency to ensure that they too benefit from the revenue from the resources.
I agree that transparency is the key, and it's been proven. In 2009, the Sierra Leone government signed a deal with a foreign mining company, but when the contract was made public, there was widespread condemnation of it, as it did not comply with the law. Eventually, there were some changes made, but it would have been better if there had been an open contracting process in the first place.
That's exactly what happened when the mining company I was working for in Ghana insisted that the Ghanaian government officials make the contract public before it was put before Parliament for ratification. When we requested such openness, I think they were taken aback because this process had never been adopted in West Africa before, and it set the bar really high for other foreign companies doing business in the area, as it became a precedent that helped build trust and credibility. It was a win-win situation for the country as a whole and the investor.
Those situations in Sierra Leone and Ghana, however, seem to be the exception rather than the rule. The community leaders I've spoken to say that it's great to have access to revenue information, but all too often there is little impact or change at ground level. In other words, new schools, roads and public services have not materialised. So, in my opinion, transparency, in which the public is made aware of the nature of contracts drawn up between the government and companies, must only be treated as a single prerequisite step in the fight against poverty. If that transparency results in accountability and people don't turn a blind eye to the terms of the contract, then money can be spent on sustainable development.
That's a good point. When contracts are open to public scrutiny, government officials know they will be accountable for the terms of the deal and will be under public pressure to sign deals that are acceptable for citizens. Then, systematic transparency will be adopted as the norm, and all stakeholders will be involved in the negotiating process.
Again, that's a good starting point, but it's one thing to make government documents available to the public in their original form, and it's quite another to ensure that communities understand what the contracts entail. It takes years of professional training to be able to plough through legalese, the complex language of the law, and grasp the meaning precisely. Rather than exploiting this to maintain the communication gap, some governments have changed the form of the documents, using new tools that simplify the contracts in order to distribute information that can be readily understood. Then communities can gauge the real-life impact of contracts drawn up by governments and companies involved in extracting natural resources.
And when communication channels are clear, negotiations can be conducted without government intervention. Take, for example, the agreement made between Rio Tinto and the indigenous community in Australia. The meeting not only involved discussing the best way to distribute revenue from the mining operations, but also how to reduce poverty. And there were other issues on the agenda too. Discussions centered around the mining not compromising the quality of the soil, air and water so that the operations would not lead to serious health concerns. I only hope that such negotiations set a precedent for other operations related to natural resources, and they become the norm rather than the exception.
I think...
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4.